Stravinsky and Schiller. We're using Igor Stravinsky and Schiller to position ourselves in a very precarious situation. We've been talking about art for 2 months, and we have another 4 weeks to go, so that we're two-thirds of the way through the presentational structure of our quarter season on art. Two-thirds is a very interesting kind of geometric position. The ancient Egyptians spent all of their effort and ingenuity and mathematical prowess to be able to find a formula to ascertain two-thirds of anything. And it was the first working proportion in human history. If you can find two-thirds of something, you have a PowerPoint. The origins of this actually go back to Paleolithic times. If you have a spear, the optimum place to hold a spear, to throw it with any kind of force, is two-thirds of the way back. So on a spear, there are two salient points. One, the balance point, where you hold it to find out whether the spear has balance, which means it's going to be aerodynamically sound when thrown. And the second is the throwing point, which is two-thirds the way back. Now, it's true that later on, in order to increase the power point, that slings were made to capture the end of the spear, so that when you hold it two-thirds the way back, you also hold a sling, and you can get a lot more power and oomph in throwing a spear. The basic point is that where the human hand goes for comprehension very often is a two-thirds point. This kind of composition is the earliest form of what we would now call, in terms of navigation, triangulation. And in terms of our upright posture, keeping track of where we are is a matter of triangulation. The inner ear sends kinesthetic balance modes on the three dimensions of space, and this is how we keep our balance. One of the problems in virtual reality with the helmets is the disorientation, because you do not have a sense of balance at all. And the gyros that are used to keep your virtual reality program going and relevant to your brain input increasingly falls behind, because they are just milliseconds off. And the whole sense of motion sickness that comes with virtual reality comes because the images seem jittery and your balance seems slightly off. You get seasick or you get a vertigo. And all of this is tied to the fact that in nature, our two-thirds point is a kind of a balanced power place. The center gives balance in a static way, but the two-thirds point gives balance in a dynamic way, so that there's a transfer between the center and the two-thirds point. Now this transferring is a key to the way in which the mind develops, so that there is a real connection between the hand and the mind. I'm sure that you've run across it in your readings or in your experience, where people talk about how the mind and the hand are linked together. Jacob Bronowski, in his wonderful Ascent of Man PBS series many years ago now, said the hand is the cutting edge of the mind. We learn best and quickest if we put our hands onto something. It's true that the hands have to be freed, and that the whole act of getting off all fours and standing up and being bipedal, standing on two becoming a biped and then freeing the hands is really the first step. And then the second step is learning to use the hands together. And very often, the eyes and the hands work together with the balance. So you get this kind of a triangulation. For instance, in the higher primates, those that were favored by evolution were the ones that could coordinate the eye and the hand and the balance fine enough. The eye, in order to pick out ripe fruit, that's the classic designation, that if you cannot tell the color ripeness of fruit, that particular species is going to be at a disadvantage from those that can. The coordination of the hands, the coordination of the balance, the coordination of the eyes. So that the mind, let's not even say the mind, let's just say that the brain as a functioning physiological structure works on this basic kind of triangulation. You have to have the hands and the balance first. So the two-thirds point in that triangulation for the development of the brain, so that the brain proceeds along, is to have balance, your feet, and a coordination with your hands. Once you have that, then you have a place, as one would say, on which to stand, a place to really grasp the world. And so developing balance and developing coordination is the very first thing that babies do. Very first thing they do. As soon as a baby begins to raise up from crawling, as soon as there's that kind of freeing of the hands, and as soon as the hands begin to come together, the sounds of the gibberish begin to form into words. So that language is an implosive indication that that particular power point has been grasped, that the balance has been shifted now to a dynamic mode. And in human beings, language is the dynamo. The mechanistic way of talking about it would be it's the engine that drives the development of man, language. Now there's a great confusion that happens vis-a-vis art. Art is several orders higher than this particular development. And to confuse these is a source of a lot of aggravation. Aggravation individually for artists, aggravation for all of the constructs that presuppose that they know what art is and usurp its invaluable and unique position. Now, in order to understand this, I've given this little bit of a prologue. Let's come to a different technique, one that we use very often here, and that is the incisive pointing of a finger at a place where the knot of complication is tied. We're going to point at a complication, point at a knot, and undo that and retie it as a bow. Now, the difference between a knot and a bow is that you can untie a bow and you get a present, where a knot just makes more tension the more you fuss with it. It's a symbolic way of looking at this. The incisive finger here is a quotation from Stravinsky from The Poetics of Music, page 53 in this Harvard University Press paperback. The quotation is this. Invention presupposes imagination. Invention presupposes imagination, but should not be confused with it. What we imagine does not necessarily take on a concrete form and may remain in a state of virtuality, that is, potentiality, whereas invention is not conceivable apart from its actual being worked out. So that imagination involves a doing. And when that doing is integrated into its process, then invention, which is the basis of art that Stravinsky is going to be talking about, begins to develop. Why does imagination in itself not serve this purpose? This is the whole point that Stravinsky makes in this particular lecture at Harvard. This was the third lecture, The Composition of Music. He's writing in here that one time during, I think it was the First World War, where he was trying to cross a border, and one of the guards looked at his passport. And he said, well, what do you do? And Stravinsky said, I invent. I'm an inventor. And the man said, well, this passport says that you're a composer. And Stravinsky said, well, that's what I mean. I invent music. And he got into this terrible conversation that the guy was going to, you know, you, no one invents music. Yes, he said, I invent music. There's the quotation. There's the finger on the knot. Now, here's our educational development. And I'll just go through it. It's just a short little two-thirds of a page argument. I'm going to name a number of items that form a set. In this set, the first item is culture. The second item is tribe. The third item is society. The fourth item is tradition. The fifth item is language. The seventh is myth. Sixth is myth. Seventh is experience. Seven items. I'm not playing with ancient archetypes that this is some kind of hebdomad that we now have to break through. Culture, tribe, society, tradition, language, myth, experience, all are on the same horizon. They all exist on the same horizon. They're somewhat interchangeable. They're all variants of each other. All of them are based on imagination. Without imagination, none of these come into being, come into play. Culture, tribe, society, tradition, language, myth, experience, all are based on imagination. And the operative way in which they are based is there is what we can call an image base. And this image base transfers natural reference to operations in the culture, in the tribe, the society, tradition, language, myth, experience. So that an image base is a transferring matrix that takes natural reference and allows them to be applied imaginatively in a representational way. And this act, produced millions of times a day, produces the constructs of culture, tribe, society, myth, language, experience, tradition. But we have seen in our education, we saw at the beginning of last year that nature in no way is objective. It is an illusion that nature is objective, and it's a delusion to act as if it were. The more that we can press the so-called objectivity of nature, the more it yields and breaks away and shows us. Structures become molecular, molecules become atomic, atomic become particles, and the particles disappear into energy states, and that disappears into a mystery. So that the wisest, realistic way of regarding nature is not an objective aggregation of things, but as a matrix of change. Now, nature as a matrix of change not only makes sense, but one can deal realistically with it on that basis in those terms. So that when an image base is transferring natural reference to the construct of society, to making a culture, to making a tradition, to making language, to the making of experience, to the making of myth, that image base transferring those natural reference does not transfer something in nature, because there are no things in nature. It's a matrix of changes. The sleight of hand motion that fools us, that author's illusion, that's at the very basis of delusion, is that an image-based transferal transfers not things in nature. The key word here is referent. And referent refers to ritual. An image base transfers the ritual comportment iotas, not natural things. So that rather than cultures or traditions or experience having a natural basis, they have a ritual basis. They actually, upon real close inspection, real attentive watching, deep structural analysis, profound appreciative comprehension, one finds that an image base transfers ritual objectivity. So that image bases transfer ritual comportments, so that words represent pointings, not natural points, is a very powerful idea. You can push the whole planet out of orbit with that idea. Words are not natural things, but they're the pointings. Book, Tarzan. It's like on a level that's so swift and sleight of hand like a magician that we miss it unless we're alerted to it, and once you're alerted to it, you never miss it again. It's like waking up, it's like a eureka. And you realize that the constructs of culture, the constructs of society, the very constructs of experience, the very constructs of language are shifted. They're no longer in a balance point, but they're in a dynamic point, and the dynamic point is determined by the rituals. That's worth knowing. Understanding that and all of its repercussions is really worth knowing. It gives one, for the very first time, a realistic place upon which to assess not only what other people are doing and what you are doing, but what in the hell is going on in general as you want, as specific as you want. Because words represent pointings, not points. Thus, language reference are habitual locks by their very nature. And the more that we use words, the more they lock in to this ritual referent comportment. And because ritual is always a selection out of nature, is never nature. And very often the selection is unnatural, because the selection tends to be what can be reduced down to a limited activity, a limited sets of actions. So that in a very peculiar way, the more that the image-based process goes on, the more that it transfers into words, the ritual foundation, the more that that language becomes unnatural, separated from nature. Not unnatural like in a perverse way, although it can be perverse. We're not even talking about that yet. We're talking about the fundamental way in which all languages become non-natural. All cultures become non-natural. All experience becomes non-natural the longer it goes on. The more that an image base works, the more that it transfers not nature into language, but ritual pointings into language. So that culture, tribe, society, tradition, language, myth, experience are, as time goes by, as use proceeds, I have procures. It's a Freudian slip, right? Culture, tribe, society, tradition, language, myth, experience. That whole set was very important to us. That whole set, as time goes by, as use proceeds, becomes frozen, locked up, petrified, stolid. So that if there were not some other process happening, it would lead to a dead end very quickly. In fact, in the world as we observe it, these built-in structural dead ends lead to a petrified dead end very quickly. And that's why most species do not develop beyond certain initial level of language, certain initial level of society. It's true that everywhere in nature we find not only primates, let's take insects for a while. Ants and bees especially have cultures, they have societies, they have chemical-based and dance-based languages. But they don't get very far with it. Why? Not because they're dumb, but because the whole process of how these evolve, of how these come to be, has a built-in terminal, petrifying dead-endedness. We're the only species on this planet that goes beyond that. And the key to how we go beyond that are symbols. The only way that we go beyond is to make a transformation. Because the process of transferring in itself is limited. It's dead-ended. So that in objective, realistic assessment, without viable symbols, cultures, experience, language, myths, societies, tribes, all of that are dead ends. They are inherently dead ends and are only kept alive. They're only viable because there is an egress from that dead-endedness. And the egress is through the development of mind. And mind is the functioning of symbols. Only the transformational process of mind, of symbols, saves the culture, the tribe, the society, saves the tradition, saves the language, saves the mythology, saves the experience from itself. Doesn't save it from some bad guys, doesn't save it from some evil, doesn't save it from demons, doesn't save it from whatever, whatever. Saves it from itself, from its own inherent built-in process of dead ending. Now, a really powered, advanced, highfalutin, high Dharma yogas, this particular realization threshold is like the sound barrier before the days of Chuck Yeager, before October 14th, 1947. The closer that you approach that, the more rattling that you get and vibrational shakeup that you get. Why? Because it's just like a virtual reality simulation. You're running up against the edge where the triangulation of imagination no longer works. It's supposed to do that. It's one of its built-in protective early warning systems to allow it to be what it is, that, hey, you're getting out of the realm where I can function. And you have to talk to your body, you have to talk to your brain, just like a parent to a really disturbed, troubled child. Easy. Take it easy. Because everything tells you that this is forbidden. It's not like forbidden fruit. It's like, period. It's like edge of the world stuff. It's like frame of reference stuff. So that in medieval times, when there was such a regression that human beings fell back underneath that threshold, the illustrations that show human beings even tempting to go out of that are catastrophic. The edges of oceans in the maps have these terrible sea monsters out there. It's Oshet time. The cosmos has this great arc under which there are all these stars, and above which is this vast, terrifying void. And one medieval illustration has this hermetic philosopher looking outside, and his eyes are wide with panic. When one looks at the early origins of human beings who went through that transformational symbol barrier, when you look at the earliest indications of civilization, back in early Sumeria, about 6,000 years ago, we find statues, and the statues are figures that have their arms down to their sides, and their eyes are just huge. The pupils completely dilated, and they have a stunned look on their faces. But they are dressed in well-arranged robes that have floral patterns on them to indicate that this was something that was gone through, the terror was gone through with grace, that they prepared themselves sacrificially to go through this. And even 4,000 years ago, when the rudiments of the language that became Greek were being used in the ancient Near East, it is called in archaeology and linguistics today, Linear A. There was a later version called Linear B, and then a later version than that called Archaic Greek. And then there was Ancient Greek, and then there was Classical Greek, and then there's New Testament Greek, and Medieval Greek, Demotic Greek, Modern Greek, so forth. At the very origins of that language, the symbol of wisdom was the owl of Athena, who has these big eyes that have been able to see outside of the constraints of the culture, outside of the defining boundaries of the society, outside of the image-based referential set of the language, so that the injunction was, silence is golden at this particular point. There's nothing you can say. There's nothing you can say, not because you're dumb, but because you're wise. You know there's nothing to be said, because at this point, you have transcended above the whole horizon where language makes sense at all. You have transformed out of where the tradition keeps you secure. And in this new realm, in ancient Sumeria, it was called by a word which later on in ancient Iranian became the root word from which the term magi came from. And eventually, in the English language, during the high occult Middle Ages, the term magic came into English, and that realm was referred to as the magical world, the magical realm. And that magical realm was supranatural, because symbols in transforming the whole culture, the whole language, into a mind, into a symbolic mind realm. That symbolic mind realm in turn transforms into the magic realm of vision. And the realm of vision is at least two orders beyond that where societies, where cultures, where traditions, where experience is comfortable. That means it's not only gone through a transformation, but two transformations, two orders higher. And art is an order higher than that. So if the artist is already like someone from another star system, might as well be. The artist in no way belongs in the constraints of the culture, of the society, of the tribe, of the tradition, of the language, of the myths, of the experience. So when we come to Schiller, when we come to the ninth letter, 200 years ago already, somebody is able to write discursively in German originally, but translated into the English. What does Schiller write? Schiller writes, art like science, this is in the ninth letter, art like science is absolved from all positive constraint and from all conventions introduced by man. Both art and science rejoice in absolute immunity from human arbitrariness. Why from human arbitrariness? Because one can, at that remove, three orders above it, one can see in this very powerful triangulation of symbols, vision, and art, one can see that all cultures are arbitrary. All languages are essentially arbitrary. All traditions are arbitrary. And what's more shaking, all experience is arbitrary. One becomes absolutely astounded and is glad for the silence that you learned way back when you were a neophyte coming into real wisdom. You realize that the gurus, the teachers, the this, that, and the other, who talk a good game are full of crap. There's not one thing to say after that first transformation. But one learns to say, one learns to save language in a new way. One begins to use, instead of mythic language, one uses a magic language, which has a symbolic, operative grammar. And when you have a symbolically operative grammar, you can use a visionary language, but the language works in a different way. It no longer works in a ritual-based way. It no longer integrates. The language differentiates. And if you're expecting it to work the old way, it's like trying to pick up the spear to throw it, only the activity that you do now, your hand completely dissolves the sphere into molecular and atomic structures. And your hand dissolves into molecular atomic structures, and the target dissolves into molecular, and you dissolve. And if you're not ready to play creatively in a universe that's real, you fall apart. Why do you fall apart? Because you're clinging to a belief structure that's still locked into something that no longer even exists. And falling apart is not being crazy. Maintaining sanity on the old basis is crazy. That's what's crazy. One of the best human beings ever to deal with that particular paradox was August Strindberg. And in Strindberg's dramas, one finds again and again the torrential discovery that he was sane when he was crazy. Yeah. And Strindberg, such a courageous character. I mean, when he intuited that he was going crazy, he moved to the best place in Paris and thought, I'm going to go out in style. Yeah, none of this little Garrett stuff. And to treat himself, he kept notebooks. The first notebook's called Inferno. And it's a nice Strindbergian record of him going crazy. It's a great time. And then as he got deeper in it, the next notebook is called Alone. And it goes downhill from there, but it gets more and more intense. And finally, Strindberg realized. He realized, because he's an artist, he said, this stuff is good. There's no way I can be crazy and write art. So he decided to make money on it. And Strindberg's symbolist plays after that are unbelievably great. Unbelievably great. They bear titles like The Ghost Sonata, The Dream World, lots of interesting things. Let's come back to Schiller, because we didn't finish the quotation. Let's come back to Schiller, refresh, and then we'll take a break. Art like science. This is Schiller. This is 200 years ago. Now, our education is working 200 years minimally after Schiller. All this is old hat. Where we are today is really a long way beyond even this. Long, long, long way. But the university systems. Art, like science, is absolved from all positive constraint and from all conventions introduced by man. Both rejoice in absolute immunity from human arbitrariness. The political legislature and the political legislator may put their territory out of bounds, but cannot rule within it. The politician can proscribe, that is, condemned to death, the lover of truth, but truth itself will prevail. Why? Because in its functioning, it's on a higher order of reality, and so it's able to index. One of the peculiar qualities of a higher order is that it indexes the orders lower than it. symbols can index cultures, languages, experience, traditions already. By index, mean integrate it further so that you control it. Someone who is able to position a symbolic mind in any of these items in this horizon is completely free of its constraints. You don't even have to be a magician. Much less an artist. So a real artist is fantastically beyond. It's like, what do we say today? Light years beyond. Here's a Henry Moore, a photograph of a Henry Moore sculpture. This is a Madonna in a differential mode. This is a protective mother form and a nascent savior child form coming together, expressed in differential, conscious way. There's no way that a culture can embrace this and survive as a culture. It has to transform into a civilization in order to do this. Because the very structure of a culture, the very structure of a tribe, forbids working this work of art in and maintain itself. And so the prim, very forthright tribal chieftains spit on this sort of thing and spear the artist. Always, always going to do this until they're educated. It does no good to eradicate them because the problem is not with them. Good news for those who have subconscious Nazi leanings, right? That's not going to work anyway. It would never would work. You can forget that. It's stupid. It is itself a cultural solution to a transcultural problem. It is itself a limited, petrified, dead-end society solution to a dead-end society problem. The Nazis are a perfect example of people frozen and locked into a dead-end experiential realm. So those kinds of situations are not even within the discussion range. What works is that nature, being not objective itself, loves transformation. Mother Nature loves transformation. And she favors us, while the ritual, the guys running the rituals do not favor us, Mother Nature favors us. She says, go ahead, play. Great. So that nature willingly gives herself over to mind directly. And anybody who's had even the beginnings of realization understands that nature loves us in that realm. We look over the fences that ritual and myth have built, and we look into this wonderful, nourishing stew of nature, and we're invited to play in it. Take the clothes off and dive in. That's what Mother Nature likes. Let's take a break. Let's start up again by coming back to Schiller. His book is not a book of essays, it's a book of letters. 27 letters to a friend. Letters in Latin are called epistles, so that you can say that there's an epistle. Epistolary style. This epistolary style is meant to convey not ideas, but character. Letters convey the character of the letter writer and also disclose the character of to whom the letter is addressed, and the subject matter, like all gossip, is about people. So while essays are a literary form to carry ideas, letters are a literary form to carry character and character forming. So when Schiller is in this great age of revolution, the age of Blake and Napoleon and Beethoven and Jefferson and Shelley, Goethe, they're trying to change everything. In France, the French Revolution turned the clock back to the year one. These people were serious about an impasse that they had come to recognize. It was a very serious impasse. It was not the impasse of an ordinary culture. It was not the impasse of an ordinary society. It was not the impasse of an ordinary horizon of experience. It was the impasse of an event about 100 years, maybe 120 years at its beginnings, but about 100 years before them. That event, in German, I think it's called Aufklärung, the Enlightenment. When we get to history in a month, we'll talk more about the great ideas of history and how there are periods of history, which are phases of history, and how they work. How the medieval phase slowly matured to a very high point and suddenly flamed into a renaissance. And the renaissance evoked a response which was called a reformation. And the reformation evoked a response called a counter-reformation. And the counter-reformation made of the 17th century a mess. And out of that mess grew a new focus called the Enlightenment. And everyone at the time, Newton, Franklin, Voltaire, Montesquieu, Hume, they felt that the Enlightenment was really the maturation of man, and it wasn't until the end of the 1700s, not the 1600s that were a mess, but the end of the 1700s, at the end of the Enlightenment, it became apparent that they were in another cul-de-sac, that instead of being freed, they had made a superculture that was just as hidebound as any culture. That the culture of the Enlightenment was still a dead end, and it was shocking. That's a Jewish ending, shocking. And so the Enlightenment crashed into its own limitations, and the only way to get out of that particular impasse, because they hadn't seen this for a very long time, and even at that time they didn't realize that man had gone through that about 2,000 years before, in what were called Hellenistic times. But those studies were ignored until the end of the 20th century. They had no idea of how to get out, and so the Enlightenment was replaced by a historical period called the Age of Revolution. And the Age of Revolution gave way to the Romantic period, and the Romantic period is characterized by Beethoven and Frankenstein. That no matter what man seems to do on a cultural level, on a societal level, he ends up trapping himself over and over again in spite of himself, and maybe the only solution is that there needs to be some superman who breaks through it all. If they lock the doors, kick the goddamn walls down. that kind of thing. Schiller comes right at the threshold of that and is perhaps, along with Jefferson, the most conscious person about what's going on and how to deal with it. And Schiller's On the Aesthetic Education of Man is the best document that there is about this particular quandary. What is the quandary? The quandary is the character of the artist who is the most likely Superman. It doesn't seem like it to us in our age because we're conditioned by a culture that doesn't respect art or artists at all. Here in the eighth letter, the last paragraph, and the first paragraph of the ninth letter, we get in two letters, in two epistles, in two successive paragraphs from two different letters, the end of one, the beginning of the other, we get this link which Schiller is trying to convey about character and about its incredible, ineffable necessity for art. Character is indispensable for art. The artist. There's no art without an artist. And the artist needs an uncanny supernatural courage, because in order to function as an artist, that artist needs to utilize a magic language, a creative imagination, and it goes very often counter to all of the underpinnings that one thought were secure, much less respectable, much less really necessary. And this gets into very deep water very quickly. Here's the last paragraph of the eighth letter, and then the first paragraph of the ninth letter. Schiller writes in translation, "Is it not then enough to say that all enlightenment of the understanding is worthy of respect only insomuch as it reacts upon character? What good is an enlightenment unless somebody is able to embody it, be it? What the hell good are encyclopedias of ideas if there's no one who can work those in together and use them and be them? To a certain extent," Schiller, "to a certain extent it also proceeds from character. Not only goes in to make up character, but also goes out from a resonance of character. Proceeds from character, since the way to the head must be opened through the heart. The development of man's capacity for feeling is therefore the more urgent need of our age." Now notice how surprising and how powerful this is. The Enlightenment talks about ideas on encyclopedic levels. Schiller, dealing with the real issue accurately, talks about the heart and about the necessity of feeling being opened up from the constraints that cultural imagination has left it in, like an abandoned child. One of the most revolutionary of all human beings was Mozart. Frail, little, young Mozart. Why? Because he opened up vast realms of human feeling that had never been seen before. The range of human feeling before Mozart and the range after Mozart are catastrophic. The range opened up by Mozart still hasn't been explored. And the range opened up by the great American mystical composer Alan Hovhaness is nothing short of star system wide. So very often, the musician who deals artistically with the realms of feeling in their supernatural, transformational realms are the pioneers. But one can mistake the pioneering courage of musicians as just some new twist on a cultural impasse as it happens in the 1990s. There's almost no new music at all. And yet, there are pretenses to new music everywhere. One wants to ask, what the hell's going on? Here's Schiller. Let's come back. Notice the technique of going back and then trying it again as a recursion technique. And it's part of the way in which differential resonances work. Because by going back again and again in different angles of vision, one sets up a new kind of triangulation, not the triangulation of the point, which is actually the triangulation of the pointing, but the triangulation of the correspondence, so that one gets resonances which lead to consonants, rather than reductively saying, well, it's only that. Because in reality, no matter how fine and how forceful your finger points, there's nothing there. You can use any finger, including the middle one. There's still nothing there. So the dictators are actually irrelevant. It's terrible for dictators to be told this. Schiller again, in a letter. It is not then enough to say, is it not then enough to say that all enlightenment of the understanding is worthy of respect only in so much as it reacts upon character? To a certain extent, it also proceeds from character, since the way to the head must be opened through the heart. The development of man's capacity for feelings is, therefore, the more urgent need of our age. Not merely because it can be a means of making better insights effective for living, but precisely because it provides the impulse for bettering our insights. When you teach a man to feel in a wider way, he will be more of what he really is. The first paragraph of the ninth letter. But, notice he begins it, but, it's linked. But, is this not perhaps to argue in a circle? Intellectual education is to bring about moral education, yet moral education, character, feeling, yet moral education is to be the condition of intellectual education. All improvement in the political sphere is to proceed from the ennobling of character, but how, under the influence of a barbarous constitution, is character ever to become ennobled? Is it not an impasse? On the level of experience and the level of myth, it is an impasse. There's no way out. But because symbols function, because the mind actually is very real, very objective. The mind is very objective. Ideas are very objective. They're as real as ritual actions. Schiller writes, to this end we should presumably have to seek out some instrument not provided by the state, not provided by the authority that holds the society, the culture, the tradition in its grasp. Where are we going to find this? To this end, we should presumably have to seek out some instrument not provided by the state and to open up living springs, which, whatever the political corruption, would always remain pure and clear. I have now reached the point to which all my preceding reflections have been tending. All eight letters in the first paragraph of the ninth. What is it? This instrument is fine art. Such living springs are opened up in its immortal exemplars. Now, this was not only new, but there were many educated people. There were people like Jefferson, there were people like the young Shelley, there were people like Beethoven, people like Goethe, who recognized when they read what Schiller was writing here that he had struck a resonant chord that had been sounded about 300 years before. The resonant chord was struck 300 years before in Florence in the Renaissance. That art, fine art, was a transformational instrument if it were in the hands of a matured human character, the artist, who could use it completely and in their own individual way. When you're in a corrupt political situation, when you're in a mad culture, a mad society, and it's doubly cemented by repressive, retroactive, radioactive kinds of reductionisms, and the thing gets very complicated, so that any energy put into that is distributed immediately into furthering those who have the power. The so-called San Francisco Renaissance in the 60s, object case in point. It was fantastic for the first half of 1966, and as the rest of 1966 went on, it became more and more reductive. So the beginning of 1967 was about as bleak, a tragic view as you could imagine, whereas exactly 1 year before, it had seemed like the whole world had opened up. 1 year. Because the reductive qualities, the distributive way in which energies, naively and unmatured, get co-opted, are phenomenal. You have to see it yourself to believe it. You can rub your eyes and you can say, how and how can this be? These are great things. These are good people. This is fantastic. Yes, but they weren't mature. It's like sending a rich kid into the casino. They vacuum your money. Come in, my boy. It's only the mature character that can use that fine art instrument that completely baffles this preemptive distributive strike against the energy. And so what develops here from Herr Schiller is the artist as a revolutionary hero. No wonder it's his lyrics that Beethoven uses for the Ninth Symphony, talking about freedom. In this fight for human dignity and freedom, the mature artist in complete command of a fine art medium, no matter what it is, pokes holes in the tyranny that they cannot patch. Because the whole source of their continuing in power is their ability to reductively distribute the energy of other people, not their energy. They use you. And as long as there's enough fodder of other people's energy, they're going to stay in power. They're going to stay in business. But as soon as you puncture that whole horizon of possibility, which a great artist does, their balloon is never again going to hold air. How's that? Never again. Once a tyrannous culture is punctured, it never again is effective. It runs on habitual steam, on the inertia of people to recognize it and change, but it never again works. Never. So the importance of maturing the human person is extraordinary and is linked indissolubly with the achievement of the mature artist being able to produce fine art in some medium. And the very next paragraph is the one that we started with today. Art, like science, is absolved from all positive constraint and from all conventions introduced by man. Both art and science rejoice in absolute immunity from human arbitrariness. The political legislature may put their territory out of bounds, he cannot rule within it. He can proscribe the lover of truth, truth itself will prevail. He can humiliate the artist, but art he cannot falsify. True, nothing is more common than for both science as well as art to pay homage to the spirit of the age, or for creative minds to accept the critical standards of prevailing taste. In epochs where character becomes rigid and obdurate, we find science keeping a strict watch over its frontiers and art moving in the heavy shackles of rules. In those where it becomes enervated and flabby, science will strive to please the sycophants of research. By 1995 are like mud everywhere in the technological world. And art reduced to gratification. Give me what I want, because this is what makes money. For whole centuries, this is Schiller. This is 200 years ago. For whole centuries, thinkers and artists will do their best to submerge truth and beauty in the depths of a degraded humanity. It is they themselves who are drowned there, while truth and beauty, with their own indestructible vitality, struggle triumphantly to the surface. Why? Because the way reality works is that once something has come into being, it has its own autonomy. It's not only that unconscious things have an influence continuously, but superconscious things also have an influence. And the superconscious archetypes are much stronger than subconscious or unconscious archetypes. The littlest superconscious archetype indexes the whole universe of unconscious archetypes. So in a realistic therapy, you don't have to worry about the unconscious, the repressive subconscious. One maturation that reaches the smallest superconscious archetype will do. It's all over, game over. And so you have this theme again and again. In this particular age, artists like William Blake or Shelley's Prometheus Unbound, but the largest scale artist of this whole era was Jefferson. And Jefferson's work of art was the United States. He made a country that was like a work of art, but a differential work of art. It was wide open to creative imagination to play on scale of millions of people. It was an opera called United States, starring about 4.5 million people. It was unheard of, and it's still unheard of. That scale of production is unheard of. It's a long playing thing. It lasted until the mid-1960s. Its ideas are still viable, still there, still can be tapped, because they're superconscious ideas, not subconscious. They're still there. And anyone who matures inherits that vitality. That's the nature of reality. And so the way to fight the battle plan is through education. That's how you win this kind of war. What was the great scene that Shakespeare put into Richard III, where Richard takes his sword and smashes through an iron bar as the power of his arm? And Saladin's emissary takes a silk chiffon scarf and throws it up in the air, and he holds his sword and it falls and splits on it. That kind of power cannot prevail over that kind of accuracy. So the fine art, artist, hero has an advantage, a great advantage, and the only way to not let that advantage prevail is for the powers to be to put all kinds of obscuring labyrinths that keep people from being able to appreciate it. And as the level of appreciation rises, the flushing tide of this ocean of maturity takes care of all the pollution, washes away the mud. It's always been that way. So Schiller writes, now we can get his language a little better, even in translation. The artist is indeed the child of his age, but woe to him if he is at the same time its ward, or worse still, its minion. Let some beneficent deity snatch the suckling betimes from his mother's breast, nourish him with the milk of a better age, and suffer him to come to maturity under some distant, perhaps Grecian sky. Then, when he has become a man, let him return, a stranger to his own century. Not, however, to gladden it by his appearance, but rather terrible like Agamemnon's son, to cleanse and purify it. His theme he will indeed take from the present, but his form he will borrow from a nobler time, nay, from beyond time altogether. Those are fighting words. You can see that the word text takes on a different meaning in this kind of education. Variation. The differential mode which consciousness is operates better and better the more variations there are. Here's the molecular structure of benzene, the benzene ring. Just a slight variation produces this particular molecule. Here's the benzene ring, and the slight variation, just adding a few atoms of hydrogen, a few atoms of oxygen, and one gets vanilla. The variations on the benzene ring are unbelievable. You can make all kinds of things out of it without end. In the same way, consciousness works better and better the more variability it has. Its variability is a sign of its health. So that the human person, which takes shape not in an integration mode but in a differential mode, is more and more its own self the more variety that it has. An actor who can play only one role is not a very good actor. An actor who can play dozens of roles and still be who they are is a very fine actor. And so the mature actor is very much like the hero artist. Not constrained at all by a culture, by a society, by an experience horizon. But those are not obviated by art, but they're vitalized by it because one can go back and one can be there for a while. There's nothing wrong with culture. There's nothing wrong with society. There's nothing wrong with experience per se, or with language based on ritual and pretending to be natural. There's nothing wrong with it at all, except that when human beings have matured beyond that, you have to also mature beyond that so that you can go back and you can visit, but you don't go back thrust in some kind of reductive imprisonment. That's the whole point. There's nothing wrong in being able to be French or Jewish or Scottish or whatever it is. But in a high-powered civilization, differentiation like we have, with nuclear weapons and who knows what else, we cannot stay in those cultural modes and call it sufficient. Because civilization is a differential form. It is healthier the more variety that there is. And that variety is also covalent with freedom. We've talked about 6 or 7 times about one of the first individual figures to be able to enunciate this clearly was not in the Age of Revolution, but was at the very tail end of the Romantic period, just before the Industrial Revolution, which was like another Counter-Reformation, put another layer of mud on the situation. And there were very few people at that time, but the sharpest person at that time in the whole world was Walt Whitman. And in 1870, right at the beginning of what Mark Twain would later call the Gilded Age, everything was gilded with phony gold gingerbread. It became the muck that the First World War had to just struggle out and let out a Pandora's box of a century of war. Just before then, Walt Whitman in Democratic Vistas, taking very seriously the fact that he was somehow mystically the only voice of Abraham Lincoln left alive, wrote his book, Democratic Vistas, as the kind of book that Lincoln would have written in his old age had he have lived to do it. And at the very beginning, Whitman says, nature, if observed accurately, seems to favor only two things. She loves freedom and variation. That's what she loves. She loves human beings who open up and creatively play in reality with new ways of being. All that she cares about is that you do it. Not as a puppet of someone else, not as some emissary of some idea, not as some delusional outrigger of some recursive cultural reductivism, but it's you. As long as it's what you're really doing, part of your maturity, then that's what this universe needs. It needs that existential value. And one can read Whitman's Democratic Vistas and just rejoice at someone who had mastered a visionary language well enough that they could speak it, quote, naturally. Because by 1870, Whitman had mastered a visionary American English so that he could say, my barbaric yap sounded throughout the entire world. I'm at home anywhere with any kind of human being. I feel cosmic with my fellow human beings. And I'm not going to criticize anyone for their living, for their life. It's a tremendous statement. It's a statement of the universe of differential unity, not of reductive integration dead ends. Integration is necessary, but an integration that doesn't transform will suffocate you. You can build your rooms out of solid gold. If you close them off, you're still going to suffocate. It's not the materials that are valuable. It's the way the architecture works. And so you get someone like Frank Lloyd Wright wanting to open up the boxes that people have stuffed themselves in, have let themselves be stuffed in. Open up the box of the house so that it becomes a natural house, an organic architecture, having continuity that leads differentially out. It's this kind of art. Now, in our education, we have various examples of things. If I can find my educational pamphlet. Let me have a copy of that pamphlet. I guess my own copy up here has exited. I don't know where it is at all. In our education, we have a couple of things that go with it. Music. And the music for art is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Try sometime during the week to listen to the Ninth Symphony. But before you listen to it, try to read for yourself Schiller's language, Schiller's poem, Schiller's words, in German if you can, translate it into English or French. Read his words and read them well enough so that when you listen to the Ninth Symphony, you're able to hear the Ninth Symphony as a resonance of that particular poem, Ode to Freedom. Now, if you have a chance, there was a production of Beethoven's Ninth, which was one that would have just brought a shivering smile to Ludwig himself. The old Leonard Bernstein was in Berlin when the Berlin Wall came down. And in front of the crumbling Berlin Wall, he played a version of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and they made a video of it. It is unbelievable when you see the response of the German people's faces to that music from 200 years ago, because there's been nothing written since that captured for them that elan, that feeling, that heartful elan, that we're out and we didn't realize how suffocated we had been, and we're dazzled by the fact that life has such protean capacities. It's like entering into a jeweled existence. And you see it on their faces. And the music with the old Leonard Bernstein brings that through as clear as anything can be. Then go back recursively, not regressively, but recursively. And notice that the music for the vision was the 3 months before the art. The music for vision was Mozart's Der Zauberflöge, the magic flute. If you have enough patience, make enough time, steal enough time for yourself during the week to get Schiller's poem and listen to Beethoven's Ninth, then go back recursively and listen to or watch a production. The best production of Mozart's Magic Flute was made by the old Ingmar Bergman, a film called The Magic Flute. Leonard Bernstein and Ingmar Bergman in their old age were fantastic artists. They just simply took off their coats and skins and just played pure spirit, exactly what was there. And then realize that linking Mozart's Magic Flute with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony was the 1 week interval. The 1 week interval, and that each interval musically counts as much as a whole 12-week section, and that the music for that interval between vision and art, between Mozart and Beethoven, was a selection of a motif overture from Wagner, Der Meistersinger. Before he got to mainlining on the Parsifal level and got to be really big on the Nibelung level, the young Wagner, still tutelaged by the feeling universe of Mozart and the dramatic courage of Beethoven, in the theme to the Meistersinger, the master singers, the old medieval master singers who were able to sing folk songs on level of art and created Renaissance sparks everywhere. That particular piece of music, the overture to the Meistersinger, has a quality which leads and links directly the magic flute of Mozart to the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven. In fact, you'll recognize the music from the overture of the Meistersinger. It's used millions of times a day everywhere for usually the most happy events of people's lives. And you'll recognize it when you hear it. That progression from the magic flute to the overture to the Meistersinger to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony has a culmination. Its culmination is the music to the interval between art and history. And the music for that culmination, just like Mozart's magic flute pairs itself with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the overture to the Meistersinger pairs itself with Brahms' Violin Concerto. Now, if you can steal enough time to listen to those four pieces of music in that kind of a structure, that quaternary of moving from Mozart to Brahms, from the magic flute to the violin concerto, is an enormous journey of maturity. It's an unbelievable journey of maturity. Because Brahms in the violin concerto uses musical structure lyrically, which have been impossible before. It was only essayed slightly by the old Beethoven in the last string quartets. But when you hear Brahms in his vigorous maturity, because he had understood the music consciously, the lyrical quality, the musical structure, and by the time he gets to composing his violin concerto, one then has an enormous kind of maturity. And when we get to history, we have to jump over from Brahms to a completely different level of differentiation of human consciousness. Completely different level of differentiation of human consciousness. And the piece of music that's used for that is Ralph Vaughan Williams' Seventh Symphony, Symphonia Antarctica, where one has an obverse of the triumph of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Ralph Vaughan Williams' Symphonia Antarctica, Symphony Number 7, was originally in its sketches, the music for a film called Scott of the Antarctic. It's about how sometimes human beings get outdistanced by the events and conditions arrayed against them. And it doesn't matter how mature you are, it doesn't matter how much courage you have, you're outdistanced by the situation. The whole Scott expedition to the Antarctica froze to death on their ways back from the South Pole, tragically. And Vaughan Williams' music for the film and its theme kept reoccurring to him, and he realized that it characterized the whole middle 20th century. 1953, I think, is when the symphony was finished. It characterized what had become, at that time, codified for the first time as the Cold War. That the condition of the Cold War outdistanced the maturation and courage of man that was available at that time. that the resistances and complications simply outclassed our ability to deal with it at that time. We've since grown tremendously. Stepping on the moon freed man forever from just simply the constraints of this planet. And it doesn't matter how complex this planet gets, how corrosive, we're freed from its tyranny forever if we'll just mature ourselves and avail ourselves of the super celestial archetypal vitalities that are already claimed by some of our species. They're there for us. They're free for everybody. Anybody who gets there can. And so there is a quality where the music for the interval between history and science, I looked around to try and find a piece of music that clarified that particular paradoxical quality, and I chose not a work which was classical in and of itself, but which was a modern work presenting itself as if it were classical in a humorous, in a loving mode. And I used Prokofiev's classical symphony, which indeed is a very short, very proper classical symphony, but is a very modern work which in very fine art presents itself as a classical symphony but isn't. And Prokofiev was that kind of character. There was an album cover one time that when records came out, large album covers of a painting of Prokofiev, and he looked very Russian, very somber, very proper, except that he had his tongue out. More next week.